Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Boy, oh boy, it was a busy week with a lot of companies pushing news out to the market as we entered early on conference season, especially in Vancouver. Three conferences that are ongoing and tying into Sunday, Monday at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. We see this every year where companies at the beginning of the year, especially in an environment where metals are going higher, well, all of a sudden everybody has news and thankfully they all want to come on the show and talk about it. So be sure to go back and listen to a lot of those company interviews. We are focusing this weekend show on the resource space, more driving down into the companies because of the fact that I think a lot of you hopefully are at some of those conferences. And again, just so much news has come out. We are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, when we talked with you throughout last year, which was broadly a down year for the metals outside of Q4, you had mentioned that, well, you just hadn't been making too many transactions, too many moves within the fund that you run. Now that we entered a new year and now that precious metals especially are in an uptrend, even copper, other metals are in uptrends for a couple months here. What is your portfolio strategy for this year?
Thanks for having me back on the program, Corey and Shad. Happy New Year's to you both. It's much of the same to what we discussed last year. You're correct. It's quite a quiet year from a investment deployment perspective. I think we added four names over the course of the year, and the most recent name that we added would have been back in September 2022. Last year was much more about conserving a cash position and, you know, gradually deploying the cash that we had mostly into existing holdings. So I just sent out the most recent MJG partnership letter. It's available on our website at mjgcapital.com if anybody wants to give it a look. And in essence, we're sitting at just below a 10% cash position, which, you know, relative to where we've sat since the fund's inception is elevated. It's not extreme, but I would say it's elevated. The plan here is to continue to deploy the cash and bits and pieces here over the next, 12, 15 months to the point that we're fully deployed by early 2024. However, if we see a very sharp move in the broader market, and I'm mentioning the broader markets, not the TSXV or related mining indexes, I'm still a believer, and perhaps I'm being overly pessimistic here, but I think there is more pain to come in the broader indices. Just the excesses that we saw built up and kind of come to a head in 2021, both between monetary and fiscal support, and then also just the investment psychology of the general investment populace. That was a pretty extreme combination, and I think there's more unwinding to do. I may be wrong on that. It's quite possible that the broader markets already made their lows, in the past 90 days, we'll say mid-November, and are now rallying on to new all-time highs. But I struggle to hold that belief. So I'm going to be a little bit more conservative here. If we see, broader markets continue to move, especially around the expectations and then the possible delivery of a pause in the Fed rate hike cycle, at that point, I would very much consider getting our cash position closer to the 15 or 20% range and then going back to gradual deployment. So I'm not ready to throw all caution to the wind and go all in here. There's no question it's been an awesome start to the year for the past 3-4 weeks in the junior space. We have, over a half a dozen names that are up double digit percentage point wise. The TSXV is up close to double digits percentage wise. So it's been a strong start. I am more confident saying that precious metals, gold and silver specifically, I'm feeling more and more confident that we did come to reach a definitive bottom in early Q4 of 2022 after a two plus year grinding drawdown that began in August, September timeframe in 2020. with many of hands shaken out. Only the strongest hands really remain in the PM stocks. There's, you know, strong macro narratives with continued central bank buying of gold globally. And then I also think the fight over the U.S. debt limit is going to kind of crescendo here over the next 4 or 5 months. So feeling good about the precious metals in particular. We're about 50% weighted towards gold, silver, or PGMs, which is the highest weighting we've had towards precious metals since late 2020. So that's a change. I'm feeling good there. The rest of the metals complex, though, I'm cautious about. It's going to be a very interesting push and pull between a broader global slowdown and the reopening of the Chinese economy. And right now, the reopening of China has definitely won out. We've seen massive moves in the prices of copper and iron ore and other GDP-linked metals. But I do think the jury is still out. Firstly, how quickly and how aggressively China will reopen. And then secondly, how much this will be outweighed by a slowdown in the rest of the global economies that have already been open for some time here. So I remain cautious on the battery metals and the critical minerals, even though I think the narrative for the next, you know, 3, 5, 7 years looks very promising for both.
Well, Matt, that's a great summation of kind of the macro factors that we're faced with in these markets. They've been constructive for the general markets, really for almost all markets. You've seen the cryptoverse spike higher over the last couple of months. You've seen risk on assets back on. But the commodities in general have done well. And in particular, the metals have shined. Q4 at the early, when silver bottomed first, and then GDX and GDXJ, and then eventually gold, and they started trucking higher. They've continued that momentum into the beginning of this year. But you mentioned, you know, the worries about China reopening. Will it happen? Will it not happen? The potential of recession, that maybe it's not an all clear yet. When you brought up the base metals and battery metals and critical minerals, you said you're a little more cautious. I'd love you to unpack how you think that'll play out for, let's say, the battery metals and critical mineral space, because I know you follow it so closely.
Sure. Well, and we've discussed this before on this program, but the concern I have there with, especially with the lithium juniors, I mean, we've just seen an explosion of lithium-focused names. And that, to me, is not a sign that things have to go down imminently, but it's a sign that a certain cycle is coming to a close. I mean, we have probably close to 150 to 200 lithium companies at this point spread between North America and Australia. And it seems like every day, formerly focused gold junior has, you know, found a potential pegmatite discovery on a corner of one of their previously gold focused projects. So I'm quite skeptical there. You know, uranium, for instance, fantastic metal, very interesting macro outlook there for the next 3-5 years. I think it's a great place to be invested. That said, you know, partially because of its positive outlook, there's still a bunch of speculative excitement built into the junior uranium names, for instance, or the junior lithium names. And so my concern, you know, going back to precious metals, we had a 2-year drawdown before this likely October bottom just a few months ago. All but the weakest hands were shaken out of precious metal stocks. Sentiment levels reached not all-time lows or absolute lows, but it was pretty ugly out there. Whereas if you look at much of the rest of the metal complex, you know, as recently as March of 2022, you know, in the aftermath of the Russia invasion of Ukraine, you know, we had the whole metal complex absent gold and silver, you know, rocking and rolling in that period. And so, yes, you know, folks have certainly been shaken out over the past 6 or 9 months, but it hasn't been the degree of drawdown that we saw in PMs. And that tells me that there's still quite a bit of speculative money, you know, focused in the critical mineral space, focused on these energy or battery metals, however you want to define them. And they'll do great. Like if we've seen the bottom of in the broader markets in Q4 of 2022 and we're off to the races now, like these companies will, you know, should do great from a share price performance perspective. My concern, though, is that the broader markets have a ways to go, and there's, you know, some more intense risk off periods to come. And in those periods, I think stocks that have, you know, a decent speculative premium already built into them are more vulnerable. I mean, if we go into a true risk off scenario and, you know, in 60 days from now, the market is at, you know, lows not seen even in 2022, then I think all, you know, metal equities will be hit. You know, in the very short term, our space is highly, highly correlated to major market moves. But my sense is that in the PM names, the downside will be more limited than some of these, you know, quote unquote, sexier metals. Because it is true, like the critical metals narrative and story here over the coming decade is really exciting. Like we've seen an unprecedented amount of support just over the past 12 months, really from Western governments globally. But in the most recent investor letter, I honed in on the U.S. government and Canadian government and moves that they've made over the past 12 months. And it's a pretty intense list. And it's even more surprising that this is happening with two left-leaning administrations kind of at the helms of each respective company. So I think it's real. It shows where the mining industry is likely going over the medium to long term. But just because there's government support, you know, has no bearing, in my opinion, in the short term in terms of these metal price fluctuations. And, you know, as we all know on this call, you can be very right about a metals given direction over a 3 or 5 year time horizon and very wrong in 6 months. So it wouldn't be surprising for me to see lithium prices down 70%, you know, in the next 12 months, even if it's lithium focused investments turn out to be a good bet over the next 5 years. So I think folks need to pace themselves.
Yeah, fair enough. Still early on for these sectors, right? But that can also add some of that early on fervor that brings in more investors. The interesting thing just has been, I think, more generalists, people that aren't usually invested in the resource sector, looking at some of these new metals. When you're looking at the critical metals, because of the fact that governments are so supportive, and as you said, there are just way too many juniors already that flew in here. If you were to play the critical minerals, would you focus more on the larger companies, ones that could maybe take advantage of that potential free government money easier and quicker?
Yeah, I think you really need to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And it's also going to depend on an investor's risk profile. I mean, in terms of MJG, our median market cap within the portfolio is, you know, 50 million CAD, give or take. So we're going to stick to our knitting. You know, I think if you're playing lithium, it makes a lot of sense to look at the bigger names, for instance, because they're the ones in most cases with the processing capacity, which is a key bottleneck in that story. I think decent lithium projects around the world are a dime a dozen. There are some extremely high quality, you know, new discoveries that are being drilled out that should do pretty well. But, you know, I would differentiate between lithium and, you know, say nickel, where I would argue nickel is a core component of the battery metal narrative and hasn't seen its time in the sun yet. You know, maybe that's to come. Graphite also burned a significant amount of investors about a decade ago. So there's a lot of reluctance to wade back out into the graphite space. But the reality is, you know, if you tell me that 5 years from now, lithium prices are going to stay at their current levels or even rise higher over the period, then I would say that's just as good news for metals like graphite or nickel. And then, you know, vanadium, for instance, I would say fits into the broader battery metals narrative as well, due to vanadium redox batteries and their likely, you know, exponential growth and deployment for grid scale energy storage. And that's a metal that if you're in the space, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, you'll remember the big vanadium run up of 2017. But my sense is that, you know, most generalists that have plowed into critical minerals currently are focused almost exclusively on lithium, probably even haven't heard the metal vanadium before at this point. So I think you need to pick and choose. And then, you know, on the rare earth front is also worth considering. You know, there are some late stage rare earth development companies right now that are garnering pretty substantial multiples. And there's quite a bit of risk, you know, taking one of these deposits actually through the construction phase and through into production, you know, on time and on budget. And that's assuming you can actually, you know, lock up the large capital financing that's needed for these projects. So, you know, there's an interesting name out there that I'm looking at very closely right now in the rare earth space, which I wouldn't consider it a direct miner. It does have exposure to direct mining investments. But I think there are in rare earths, there's potentially a better way to play the theme than these late stage development projects. I mean, obviously, Lynas is, you know, to your point about going for the bigger name, is kind of the blue chip outside of China right now. So that could also be a reasonable play, you know, for rare earths over a medium time horizon.
Well, Matt, let's pivot over into some of the more, I guess, stalwart base metals, things like copper, zinc, lead, and even you could throw silver in there. You had mentioned to us before we started recording, there was two companies in Nevada that had caught your eye just because of some of the recent discoveries they've made. Love you to unpack those for our audience.
Definitely. Well, one thing we saw in 2022, and this has persisted into 2023, is a lot of excitement around CRD-type deposits. Western Alaska Minerals has made a pretty exciting discovery up in Alaska, and I was able to visit their project, Illinois Creek, in August of last year. I'm excited for that group. I think they're onto something pretty exciting there. Challenges, obviously, working up north in terms of seasonality or what have you, but they're on a good trajectory. But then looking down in Nevada, there's been a lot of action just in the past few months. I-80, like I've seen enough at Ruby Hill. Like I think, maybe I'll eat my words here, but from the results I've seen thus far, I think the CRD deposit they're drilling at Ruby Hill will become a mine. You know, there's of course, you know, permitting risks, even though they're nearby operations. They need to get more visibility into the met. But I mean, we're talking 28 meter intercepts of, you know, 500 gram per ton silver and 30% lead zinc. Like those are pretty obscene grades, you know, 18 meters at 600 grams per ton silver and 40% lead zinc. Like this looks like a mine in the making. So we're not I-80 shareholders, but it's definitely an interesting story and one I've been following closely. And the share price has definitely perked up, even though, you know, they're still a gold-focused company for all intents and purposes. The market has taken notice of the CRD discovery, and it's been reflected in their share price. You know, it's also good news for Christina McCarthy's Paycor Metals. Their project's located just to the south, along trend from Ruby Hill. And Paycor's put out some decent drill results on their own. And have also benefited from the attention, I think justly so, being paid to Ruby Hill. So we've seen the Paycor, you know, share price double in the past, 90 odd days. So investors are warming to CRD plays within Nevada. Reyna Silver also put out, you know, first drill results at their Medicine Springs project in Nevada. Peter McGaw is a technical advisor there, potentially a board member. I'm not sure about that, but I think there's going to be some more noise there. And then just yesterday, Ridgeline Minerals announced the best intercept to date at their Salina project, which I've actually been to a couple times. Ridgeline, for full disclosure, is a holding of the MJG fund. We participated in their September financing last year, and they announced a 33 meter hit of 300 grams per ton silver equivalent. It includes 6 meters of 1100 grams per ton silver equivalent. Very excellent grades. And again, from a gram meter perspective, the best hit that we've seen on the property to date. So it was good to see the share price rewarded there with, you know, Ridgeline trading up on good volume, you know, up roughly 25% on the day. You know, the cynics out there could say, well, this is the first hole that they've drilled using a core rig. And especially with CRD type systems, when you're using RC, you can see core recovery drop off and hence an understated grade. So the cynic could say, well, we haven't seen a step change in grade here. This is just due to the core drill. But on the flip side, you could rebut, well, that means the RC drills that holes that they've drilled into the Chinchilla zone have understated the grade by about 33%. So I think it's a net positive actually from the company's perspective. This Chinchilla target is still completely open down plunge, and it was stated in the Ridgeline news release, and I agree with this, that they should hit it hard next year, and this coming spring when the thaw occurs, and we'll see how much capital they raise and how hard they decide to go. But this is a worthy target, and you know, VPX Mike Harp mentioned that they would look to get to first resource sooner rather than later there. So again, it's there's a lot of action on the CRD front in Nevada between these handful of names, and from Ridgeline's perspective in particular, I think it's a good time to be putting out these types of results. I think they have another 7 holes to go or so from drilling that occurred on targets elsewhere on the property. So we'll see some more news flow from them in the coming few months.
Matt, let's also talk about some transactions that have happened in the sector during what was a very quiet period, mostly over December. We saw some larger Japanese companies come into North America and put some money to work in some projects in actually a wide range of companies. There are a number of deals that happened. Take us through some of these deals. What caught your eye about these bigger Japanese miners entering the North American market?
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't heard or seen much commentary on it. I think part of the reason is that this flurry of deal activity was just in the week or two right before the Christmas holidays. I think in one of the cases, it was the day before Christmas. This was announced. So I think it flew a bit under the radar. You know, two Japanese trading houses in particular. The first is Sumitomo, which seems laser focused on gold in Quebec. And this is both earlier stage stuff and later stage stuff. From an early stage perspective, they have an earn-in deal ongoing with Kennerland Minerals, which is potentially a name your listeners are familiar with, at their Frotet discovery in Quebec. And, you know, as we speak, there's a 22,000 meter phase four drill program that's being mobilized. Sumi has already spent millions of dollars on the asset. I think they'll breach the 10 million mark with this program if they haven't already. So they're very excited and going full steam ahead there with the drill program being carried out by their joint venture partners, Kennerland. In December, and this was one of the news releases just before Christmas, they announced a similarly structured deal with Kennerland at the O'Sullivan project, also in Quebec. And it makes sense. They've had Sumitomo, at least thus far, has had tremendous success partnering and making this discovery with Kennerland at Frotet. So it makes sense that they're trying a round two at O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan's still pre-discovery, extremely high risk. I imagine it will be quite some time before the Sumitomo and Kennerland are comfortable going ahead with the drill test. But it's good to know that that's in the pipe for both parties. And then separate from Kennerland, Sumitomo also announced, I think this was the deal just announced the day before Christmas, an earn-in with Sirius Resources Aqualon Gold Project in the James Bay region. So also in Quebec. Listeners may know Sirius Resources and their later stage Chichu Gold Project. Just emphasize, this is not Chichu. This is one of their earlier stage assets. So it's interesting to see a group with the stature of Sumitomo willing to roll the dice on some very early stage gold exploration plays within Quebec. That seems to be a clear corporate strategy from that group in particular. And then I should also note that Sumi, in the same time period, announced that they were putting another $340 million into the JV at the Côté Gold Project with IM Gold to cover cost overruns. And this is a nifty deal. And in effect, they're increasing their project stake at Côté to 40% from 30%, though IM Gold has a repurchase right of that 10% that lasts for 3 years, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll see where that ultimately goes. But yeah, we saw a flurry of activity from Sumitomo into gold, into Canada, you know, just last month. And then the other one was Mitsui. They announced just one deal, but it was a pretty hefty one. This was with Taseko Mining at their Florence ISR copper project down in Arizona. It's in essence a prepaid offtake. Mitsui's putting $50 million into the construction financing package in exchange for a stream of, I believe, 3% or just below 3%, 80% of the offtake, and also a three-year option to buy a 10% project level stake. And so, yes, Sumitomo for gold, Mitsui for copper. But the similarities, as we've seen, you know, two Japanese groups move pretty aggressively into North America in just the past 60 days. It'll be interesting to see whether this continues.
Yeah, it's always nice to see certain companies and then large investment houses coming into an area and focusing on it. It kind of points out what they see the forecast being over the next 1 to 3 years, or they wouldn't be coming in so hot and heavy. Matt, just as we kind of were talking before this call, we were talking about the conference schedule and companies rushing to put out news at the beginning of the year. And we were talking about all the conferences coming up in Vancouver, from the MIF and Roundup to the Vancouver Resource Investor Conference. You're going to Miami to a conference. And that led to a discussion about PDAC coming up and the inevitable PDAC curse. And we were joking about it at first, but there actually is, you brought up some great points as to why the seasonality is the way it is this time of year. I'd love you to unpack that for folks.
Yeah, I think there is a method to the PDAC curse madness. will often befuddle market participants that it proves true in many more years than you would anticipate. And as we're discussing, I do think there are a couple structural forces that explain kind of the PDAC curse phenomenon. And the first would be psychological. And we're seeing a dose of this year, you know, the healthy New Year's optimism as you roll into a new year. So I think that's definitely been the wind at the back of plenty of juniors, why we've seen a strong start to the year. That's pretty common. So that will occur in you know, January and February. And then the hopium, so to speak, will start to fade off, which is right around the time where PDAC's taking place, you know, this year in early March. So there's psychological angle. There's also a news flow angle on a couple fronts. The first is that you have a ton of companies that will defer. Obviously, if it's truly material news, it needs to be released. But, you know, that will defer or at least time their news flow to where releases that could have come out in November or December are deferred into January and February to generate early year news flow kind of ahead of the major conference circuit. So I think you see that phenomenon. You also see companies that, you know, maybe if they weren't rushing, would be putting out potential news later in the spring that, you know, pull out all the stops to get their drill results out before PDAC. So you have a compression of news flow into a month or two period. And then you have a bit of a fallow period in the aftermath. So from a rate of change perspective, you're going from a ton of news flow, you know, some of which will buoy share prices, to now a largely quieter period for the industry. So I think that's an angle. Also, from a news flow perspective, you have to look at the seasonality of some of the more remote juniors. And this doesn't apply to all juniors in any respects, but for those operating in the Golden Triangle or up in Alaska or in the Yukon or in Nunavut, you know, there's realities of how many months in the year you can access your projects. And oftentimes you'll see the heavy news flow, you know, in Q3, in Q4, into Q1. But really between March, April, and, you know, July, August, there's a real quiet period for these more remote projects in terms of, you know, particularly drill results. And so I think that also corresponds pretty well with the PDAC curse. And whereas, you know, PDAC in early March and then March, April, May, you know, for a number of months, it goes quiet for at least these specific stories. So that's a variable. And then the other one that comes to mind is financing cycles. You know, there are certain pockets of the year. Of course, it doesn't hold true every year, but there are certain pockets of the year where you see more deal flow. There are certain pockets of the year where you see less. And there's no question at the beginning of the year. I mean, we're seeing this right now with, you know, a handful of uranium and silver companies coming to market just in the past 48 hours. I mean, there's been a real flurry of financing activity. You see a lot of activity early in the year. And lo and behold, I'm not saying it's a bad decision for these companies to raise money. It's actually, I think, a good opportunity to cash up in these market conditions. But the reality is when you raise money, that's going to hamper share price performance, at least in the short to medium term. And, you know, if you're raising a deal in January and you close it, you know, mid to late January, that means that you see the 4-month hold lift in May. Or if you close it right at the beginning of the year, it could lift in April, perhaps. And so I think also when you see these 4-month holds lifting from financing activity that's occurring early in the year, that also corresponds pretty well with the PDAC post-PDAC lull that we see. So again, I don't think it's one specific factor, but I think there are multiple variables that at least help explain why the PDAC phenomenon occurs maybe more than folks would expect.
Boy, does it occur year after year, though. In all fairness, some of these conferences always mark at least a short-term top. I think a lot of the time because so many companies push news out right before, and then they don't really have anything to follow up on. Matt, just before we wrap this up, I want to circle back to portfolio strategy, because you said something early on that I want just a little bit more color on your strategy. If you do go into a more building cash environment within the portfolio, what do you tend to trim? Do you have certain rules, whether it's stocks that have already experienced good pops or stocks that don't seem to be getting any interest? How do you go about isolating the stocks that you are going to sell to build up your cash position?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There are multiple things that I'll look at, but I mean, first and foremost, always price to value should be considered. And you know, it's very difficult to value a stock, especially to an exact cent. But for each of our holdings, I have a general sense of what I think fair value per share is, with the, you know, modesty and humility to understand that it's probably off, but I'd like to think it's with, you know, close within a band close to that level. And so we do have a couple names within the portfolio that have done quite well, you know, precious metal focused in particular, that are nearing their fair value per share in my mind. Now, when that occurs, I don't automatically sell the whole position when it hits fair value per share, because firstly, I acknowledge that it's possible that I'm understating the fair value per share. Secondly, you'll often see companies overshoot. So just, you know, it can get very overvalued on a per share basis. So the idea is to start trimming, you know, as they approach what I view fair value, and then taking chunk off the table, you know, should the share price extend beyond that level. So we do have a couple of names in the portfolio that fall into that basket. You know, I'll also do, from a portfolio construction perspective, max weightings on given positions, just to manage risk. So if we're far too heavy in a specific jurisdiction, if we're far too heavy in a specific, you know, single asset company where there's, you know, individual project risk that could torpedo the whole investment, things are going well, I won't hesitate to trim. And then, of course, you know, there's the instances where the companies either don't deliver what they said they would deliver, or, you know, they took a good shot and it's, you know, something didn't pan out from either a permitting or a geological perspective. You know, there are good people doing good work out there, but sometimes things don't pan out. In fact, the vast majority of times they don't in this high risk industry of ours. So these are all sorts of factors that I'll consider. But I mean, of the three, the one I would emphasize for listeners is the price to value. And you should be, you know, continually as an exercise, looking through your portfolio and having a sense of what you think fair value is for each of your holdings. And it doesn't have to be exact, but that exercise in its own right, I think, is very healthy. And it also helps encourage you to keep a more concentrated portfolio, because if you have 70 names, it's hard to know at any given time what each of them should be worth. It's much more manageable if you're dealing with a dozen or a couple dozen names.
All right, Matt, great chatting with you. Thank you for sharing some insights on how you're managing your portfolio. And we actually jumped around to a number of different areas within the resource sector. Look, overall, I think people are more encouraged, especially just in the last 4 months, of how their stocks have moved after a pretty tough couple years. Hopefully this uptrend continues, but there definitely are some more positive stories, thankfully, coming out of the resource sector. Matt, thank you as always for your time. Everybody, you can check out the MJG Capital website by clicking the link within this weekend show posting on our website and podcast. And we'll be chatting with Matt in the next couple months to get his updates on what he's seeing. Matt, thanks again for your time this weekend. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to focus a lot more now on, let's say, more the junior resource space when it comes down to the stocks, as we are chatting with Tavi Costa, portfolio manager at Crescat Capital. Now, Tavi, something that we've been talking about throughout this month, even last month, is how the precious metals are in more of an uptrend. It seems like everything's in at least this 3 to 4 month uptrend, but some of the stocks, especially the juniors, have started to see a little more action. We've seen random volume spikes here and there, and I've noticed pretty much all the juniors starting to move higher. Now, they're moving higher off of some pretty depressed levels, especially if you're holding those stocks 1, 2 years ago. But look, there's a bit of an uptrend here. We don't know how long this uptrend is going to last. We don't know if this is the start of a whole new bull market that could last multiple years, or if this is just a short-term bounce. But Devi, first and foremost, your thought on this uptrend in the precious metals that has now finally filtered down to a lot of the juniors and explorers.
Well, look, I think it's important to try to understand if this is a real trend or not. And in my opinion, it certainly is. I mean, it started back, you know, just go back some months ago, back in September. So we started seeing the yield curve inversion problem in the U.S. begin to really surge. We got as high as 91% of all possible spreads in the Treasury curve are all inverted. And a research of, you know, looking back prior decades where we've had similar imbalances in the credit market shows that it's time to be owning gold and selling stocks. And that means selling S&P 500 specifically as part of the research. There are times when oil actually performs very well too. But it certainly seems like we're at the beginning of a longer bull market. And it's important to put into perspective not only this macro signal that gives us high conviction to own the metal, but also the longer term thesis where we put out a research a couple, maybe a month or so ago, looking back on global production of gold, because we really had two major bull markets in the gold space going back to the 70s, and looking at both sides, they had their own kind of individual drivers at that time. The 70s was driven by inflation. The early 2000s was really driven by China entering the WTO and moving the commodity markets, becoming a manufacturing plant of the global economy. Today, we have kind of a mix of a lot of things. During those two decades, however, the one driver that happened during those two times was that global production of gold entered a multi-year decline. In the 70s, was more pronounced. We saw an 18% decline in global production of gold. And in early 2000s, all the way to 2011, it was more like a 14% or so decline. I think we're entering something similar today. The major companies are starting to look for M&A and other opportunities in the space. But really, one thing that we didn't see in the past that is happening currently is this institutional capital really attracted by critical metals, which is gold is not part of that as of now, at least. And it's actually forcing them to move away from production of gold. So we're seeing most of the major companies in the space actually facing a decline of their gold production. And that is quite interesting because perversely, I think this is going to be very positive for the overall industry over the long term. It's very similar to when the energy sector became sort of uninvestable when oil prices went negative. And instead, we've seen, you know, two incredible years for energy stocks over the last couple of years. And so it's I think it's a very similar in that sense. And we're seeing now, we first saw gold starting to move, then silver began to move as well. Even copper is now moving too, along with the metals. And the other part of it is that we started to see some of the minor companies moving along with the metals. Now we're starting to see some of the juniors. And to me, as an allocator, I love the fact that a lot of the juniors, the very smaller market cap companies in the space that we are invested, are yet to move to the same direction. If you look at the TSX volume, for instance, on a 50-day moving average of that, we're one of the lowest levels we've seen in history. Although the GDX volume and the GDXJ volume are already increasing. Remember, the TSX venture has a lot of the smaller names in the space. GDXJ is actually not a good gauge or benchmark for if you're invested in the more explorers and developers part of the industry. And so it's very attractive from that standpoint, because I feel very strongly it's going to be filtered into all parts of the industry. And as we know very well, those smaller names that have low liquidity are the ones that move the most when the institutional capital comes in. And so I think decisively, this is, you know, probably going to happen in the following months. And so I'm looking forward to continuing to really improve our portfolio as much as we can prior to this move that I think will happen.
Well, Tavi, I'd like to dig into that concept a little bit more, because I think you brought up a perfect point here, and that the metals prices did move, and the GDX and the GDXJ, which are mostly the larger producers, the mid-tier producers, a few royalty companies, and maybe a few of the largest, most liquid development stage companies, but they're not really juniors. They moved, and people said, oh, the mining stocks are not tracking the metals, but they did. The GDX went up and the GDXJ went up over 50%. Gold didn't go up 50%. It did tack on $300 from the low at 1618 and then blasting back up into the low 1900s here, but it didn't double in price. But a lot of these shares did double in price, and even some of the most liquid, larger cap developers, and even some of the most popular explorers, some of them went up 100%, 150%, 200%. So I would say that is outperformance over the metals. But most people are in these exploration stage companies, the smaller microcaps, and they haven't moved as much. And Crescat's model is really to be positioned in those exploration stories for the discovery cycle. So I'd love you to unpack why Crescat feels that, you know, at this point in the cycle, when they haven't moved as much, is that magical timing window where you can get in before the real price appreciation.
Yeah, I mean, considering none of us have the crystal ball to really answer that question precisely, but it seems to me that it's just natural how we tend to see. There's some things that are not necessarily true in the precious metal space that we hear a lot, which is that usually you have the senior companies performing better than the juniors. Well, we like to see that initially, and then you have the juniors coming in. Naturally, that makes sense, right? Logically, what happens is institutional capital chases the easiest things, and then as they look for more asymmetry, they would go down to the smaller names too. But I think that more than any other time in history, what we're seeing is this true lack of folks that can discern those good and bad opportunities, and it's not allowing the real amount of capital to come into the space in a much easier fashion that we've seen in the past. And so, and on top of it, we're certainly seeing liquidity drying up in most of other capital allocators due to what's happening globally in terms of the macro environment of the sell-off of most assets. Imagine if you're holding a 60-40 portfolio with some gold and some miners exposure. It's been brutal for that particular investor. And then there are plenty of those out there. And so it's been very difficult. Now, I do think that it's just going to be natural to see this trickle down and this cascade effect that will come into this part of the industry as we continue to see capital flowing into the top of the precious metals side of the industry. And so it would surprise me if we don't see that. And it's important to remember, you know, this critical metals part of focus for most of the major companies, it is likely to trigger an M&A cycle, but mostly not just on sole, you know, gold projects, but perhaps gold and copper projects and gold and, you know, or other metals in general, you know, related to nickel and cobalt, even zinc and so forth. And all those things are probably going to be part of this new M&A cycle in a bigger way than even precious metals. That is not to say the precious metals are not incredibly valuable. It is my favorite part of this whole thing, because we know the central banks are buying gold in a big way. And it's important to track this big changes in terms of the quality of international reserves, which I think it's a real trend. When back in the 70s, we used to see central banks own close to 70% of their balance sheet assets was actually gold. And today it's less than 20%. So it's just hard to believe we're not going to see even a double from that metric in the next years. What does that mean in terms of the influx of capital to the overall industry is going to be crazy. And so I think it is time to be taking advantage of this lag in most of the junior names. And so we've been focused on deploying capital there. We've acquired recently a large silver mine in South America. You know, silver has been one of our main focuses. It's been very difficult to find pure silver mines and pure silver assets, but that one is as close as it gets, really. And so it's it's been a huge part of us to be trying to expose ourselves to those projects. And it's but I think it's a good time to be allocating capital here, given the spread of valuations that we're seeing, especially from the seniors and developers relative to the explorers. But that's just my two cents on this.
That's a very interesting comment in how some of the critical minerals can actually go hand in hand with the precious metals in assets. We do see that all the time. And quite frankly, governments seem way more positive on the critical minerals right now. Now, Tavi, one thing that we should discuss that I think is another kind of fallacy within the precious metals sector, especially looking at the juniors, is that we hear a lot that we need the U.S. markets or the broad averages to crash, and that's going to push investors into gold and gold stocks. Well, it can push investors into gold. It doesn't usually push them into the stocks, especially the small ones. And this rebound that we have seen timed perfectly, really, with the bottom in the broad averages last year so far. How important do you think it is to see some stability in the broad averages, the U.S. markets, to continue to filter money into the juniors?
Well, what I like about the gold market, if you got some short-term drivers and long-term drivers working towards this thesis currently, the short-term and medium-term really is this yield curve inversion. I mean, really, if you look back and do empirical analysis in this data that I'm referring to, you will see that every time we go above the 70% handle of or threshold of yield curve inversions in the overall treasury curve, gold tends to outperform equity markets. That does not mean equity markets need to crash. I might have a view on this, and therefore I am short parts of the market. However, I do think the precious metal side of it looks even more appealing. Now, that's more the medium short-term thesis driving the metal prices right now. The second ones are probably even more important. One I already mentioned, which is now a lot of the gold bugs like to mention this increase of gold purchases by central banks. And that's absolutely true. But you have to look at this with the lenses of what does it mean to their overall balance sheet? Why are they doing that in the first place? It's a neutral asset, number one, but also it has to do with this idea of trying to improve the quality or credibility of their own fiat currencies by owning better quality assets, which certainly is gold relative to owning debt from another indebted economy like U.S. Treasuries or even European bonds or JGBs. Important to also track what's happening with the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, which if you look at the balance sheet assets relative to GDP has been surging, which has been kind of a separate trend relative to other developed economies have been somewhat allowing their assets to shrink by letting them mature. So that's a little bit different. Now, the two drivers that I wanted to really point out, it's the 60-40 portfolios, the shift from portfolios that have been so popular over the last 2 to 3 decades. It's just hard to believe we're going to see that. It's still popular, the popularity remaining for the next 10 years. It wouldn't surprise me if portfolios look completely different in the next 10 years by seeing gold taking a bigger role in terms of allocation and also commodities as a whole as well. But I think gold will replace most of the bonds, most of the global bonds and the fixed income assets when it comes to chasing a defensive asset. And so that on itself is going to drive over time a tremendous amount of capital to the space. The second thing that is happening alongside with the 60-40 portfolios is the 60 side of it, which is on the equity side of it, is that most people are focused too much on growth stocks for the last 2 decades or so. And that's about to change. We're seeing this transition from value to growth, which it was hard to call 2 years ago. And now it looks a lot more obvious because we had 2 years that we're seeing this transition already in place. I think this will continue. It will take a long time for investors to change their process of an approach towards selecting what to invest in. You know, this idea of doing research in the bottom line, understanding really reading 10-Ks and being part of conference calls, which is something we haven't seen the popularity as it used to be, and doing fundamental analysis. That is all coming back. And what does it mean to miners and for being part of this the value indices that we see worldwide? And so I think that that also will drive a tremendous amount of capital to the space. And this influx of that will be at some point attractive to the smaller names. And so that is, you know, imagine, you know, it's just like going back to the early 90s when technology space was getting formed. It was hard to find folks that understood well the space to discern the good and bad investments at that time. Those that were able to do that were the ones that killed it in the 90s, all the way to the peak of the technology bubble. I think we'll be somewhat similar today, given the fact that it is rare to find folks that understand geology to a higher degree. And so that, you know, creates a lot of inefficiencies naturally. And so until we see those become exploited, it will take some time.
Well, Tavi, we've made the point in the show even a couple of years ago that there would be that rotation out of bonds when the bubble was popping and rates were so low, and that it would flow into the precious metal. So agree 100% on that point. And as far as people shifting from growth to value, we saw that big time last year. But to Corey's point, do you think if the general equities were to start pulling back in a further bear market, that the gold and silver price and the critical metals prices of copper and nickel, if the commodities did well in the face of a general equity sell-off, could the mining stocks, including the junior mining stocks, still outperform general equities in that kind of environment because people are doing that fundamental research again, as you just covered?
I think absolutely. Go back to the 70s, for instance, when cost of capital was extreme and caused investors to actually be worried about profitability. And you go back to that stagflationary environment of the 73-74 period, when we did see one of the steepest recessions and one of the worst recessions we've seen in history, because it was just hard to hide. Real estate was falling. Most of the fixed income assets were falling. Equity markets were cut in more than half in terms of prices. Everything was re-rated a lot lower, but you saw still a large amount of capital coming into the commodity space, especially in precious metals, if you include gold and silver as part of the commodities industry. And so what you saw there was that the miners actually outperformed, not only, I would say, outperformed the equity markets, but actually diverge from overall equity markets by going up in value while the equity markets and other asset classes were all collapsing. Go back as well to the early 2000s when we had the tech bust. The tech bust was in the very beginning. Precious metal stocks got caught up along with equity markets. But then just a couple months after we got into this bear market, or that bear market, we saw precious metals diverging again from the overall market. And that was a very important period, which was what marked the beginning of a bull market for the overall space. And so I think it's going to be even as I said before, even a stronger trend this time around. I do think you don't have to have equity markets to collapse for gold prices to do well, but it is on the back of the macro imbalances that we have worldwide that gold will likely continue to perform as it has been over the last months. And, you know, when you think about what's happening in terms of the pillars of inflation, just because gold didn't work out during the period that we had inflation here recently, and gold sort of had an initial move, which was in line with kind of preceding this upward pressure from consumer prices, and then kind of slowed down in terms of the upward price direction while inflation was intensifying. It's important to note that the pillars of inflation remain very, very strong, meaning wages and salaries growth is still working. It's dynamic. It's going to be very secular on its trend. We've seen this kind of industrial revitalization where most of the G7 economies are going to have to kind of go back to rebuilding and reshaping their manufacturing plants. This is going to cause a similar move, but much bigger than we saw in the early 2000s with China. Imagine, you know, the G7, not just one economy, all the G7 economies having to rebuild their own manufacturing plants. What does that mean to the demand for commodities? We have the Green Revolution happening at the same time, this reckless amount of fiscal spending that often we don't talk about it, because what we're spending in terms of annual amounts of fiscal spending currently is way larger than we saw back in the 70s, even inflation adjusted. And on top of it, we have another thing that I think is even more important, the deglobalization trends. And that is even probably one of the most important and critical points of this inflationary pillars. And one last one was just the chronic underinvestments that we've seen in commodities and natural resource industries. And so you put it all together, it's just hard to believe capital is not going to flow into this space. And knowing how illiquid and how thin those markets are, it's probably going to create, you know, some very great opportunities, in my opinion. If there was ever a time to take the risk as an institutional allocator and go deep into what I think it's the true inefficiencies in this part of the industry, which are the exploration and developers, I think that time is today.
All right, Tavi, let's get into some of the stocks then. Break down which companies you like right now, which ones you think are doing some solid work, because quite frankly, boy, oh boy, there was a flood of news that has come out to begin this year.
Yeah, I mean, I was asked this question a couple months ago, and I'll stick with three names that I think are doing great work. One of them, which is a company that's been around for a long time, but continues to show success and in terms of their drill results, and also BHP, they became a large shareholder. I'm talking about Brixton Metals, and we became a larger shareholder over the years. It's one of our top stories. We think we like the work Gary has been putting in, and also like the geologist, the technical team in general is very attractive to us. We've been deploying capital for the last, I would say, 1 to 2 years into the story over time. And growing confidence, and it's a great story of Garrett's been trying to capture this investment from BHP for many years, and finally that came in, which kind of solidifies and gives us higher conviction that they're probably onto not only one thing but maybe a few things in their massive land package. Barksdale was another one that I was looking at for a while. And they needed some permits to start really working on their projects. It's the extension of the Taylor deposit in Arizona, and it's an incredibly attractive story from that standpoint, because it's almost, you know, nothing is a no-brainer, but in terms of geology, this one looks to be very close to that. And so it's really a question of the permit situation. And today we've certainly seen positive news in terms of the resolution of that issue, which I think will probably be hopefully resolved by the middle part of this year completely, and there will be able to start really working on that, those projects. And so we're excited about that one as well. We own a large percentage of that company. Altamira in Brazil. I mean, I've been chasing Brazilian assets, especially given my views on commodities and our views in commodities. And, you know, Altamira is just an example of that. It's another company that looks to me, or looks to Quinton, a lot of similarities with Snowline's projects in terms of the type of deposit we're dealing with. Lots of great results already came out, and I think a lot of people are perhaps not interpreting them correctly, and that's just part of the market. And so we've been allocating most of our capital and focus onto that story as well. It is a large percentage of our portfolio today as well, and so, or a larger percentage. Pacific Ridge is another company we like. You know, it's a unique porphyry, golden copper porphyry in DC that we like to have a large allocation as well. We own close to 20% of that company as well. It's another one that is likely onto a few discoveries, and it's, you know, it's trading for for very cheap market cap currently. It's hard to believe it's trading at those levels. And so those are just a few stories. And obviously, we still have a large exposure to other names that we like a lot, like Eloro Resources in Bolivia, Esky Mining as well, in the Golden Triangle. Snowline Gold is one of our favorite names, which continues to be a large percentage of our portfolio. And there are a few others that we, Goliath is an important position for us as well. Goliath Resources, which is also in Canada. And so those are just some of the names I'd like to feature here that I think are going to be interesting. Western Alaska, in Alaska as well, obviously is an important story for Crescent. The CRD system, you know, it's very difficult to find high-grade silver discoveries today. And here we have one already. So it's one that we'd like to maintain our focus on those. So that's sort of, there are more stories. Obviously, we run a very diversified portfolio with a lot of different investments. And while it may seem small in a sense because we have so many allocations, I do think that is an important aspect of what we do, just because it is that kind of VC approach towards this overall industry, looking for large winners that can succeed in a space where very few investors are focused on.
All right, Tavi. Hey, thanks for sharing all of those names with us. I know a lot of people probably that have followed along with Crescat know that you guys are invested in a wide range of stocks, and some of those I have heard from you before, but look, there are companies that are doing still a lot of work out there, and in no way have we seen a rush of capital into the sector. But again, the last 4 months have been pretty positive. So hopefully this better market environment continues throughout this year. Tavi, thanks for taking time with us on this weekend show. I'll be seeing you at the resource conferences in Vancouver. We're meeting up on Monday. I'm very much looking forward to that. Anybody else who is in town for the conferences, please email Shad or I, and we are happy to arrange a quick little meetup, walk around the conferences, or go for a beer. And everybody, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.